Teleborian took a deep breath. Janini was well prepared. She had surprised him with a number of tricky questions, and she had succeeded in distorting his replies. She had not fallen for his charms, and she completely ignored his authority. He was used to having people nod in agreement when he spoke. How much does she know? He glanced at Prosecutor Ekstrom, but realized that he could expect no help from that quarter. He had to ride out the storm alone. He reminded himself that, in spite of everything, he was an authority. It doesn't matter what she says. It's my assessment that counts. Janini picked up his forensic psychiatric report. Let's take a closer look at your latest report. You expend a great deal of energy analysing Elizabeth Salander's emotional life. A large part deals with your interpretation of her personality, her behaviour, and her sexual habits.
In this report I have attempted to give a complete picture.
Good. And based on this complete picture, you came to the conclusion that Lisbeth suffers from paranoid schizophrenia.
I prefer not to restrict myself to a precise diagnosis.
But you have not reached this conclusion through conversations with my client, have you?
You know very well that your client resolutely refuses to answer questions that I or any other person in authority might put to her. This behaviour is in itself particularly telling. One can conclude that the patient's paranoid traits have progressed to such an extent that she is literally incapable of having a simple conversation with anyone in authority. She believes that everyone is out to harm her, and feels so threatened that she shuts herself inside an impenetrable shell and goes mute.
I notice that you're expressing yourself very carefully. You say, for example, that one can conclude.
Yes, that's right. I am expressing myself carefully. Psychiatry is not an exact science, and I must be careful with my conclusions. At the same time, it is not true that we psychiatrists sit around making assumptions that have no basis in fact.
What you are being very precise about is protecting yourself. The literal fact is that you have not exchanged one single word with my client since the night of her 13th birthday because she has refused to talk to you.
Not only to me. She appears unable to have a conversation with any psychiatrist.
This means that, as you write here, your conclusions are based on experience and on observations of my client.
That's right.
What can you learn by studying a girl who sits on a chair with her arms crossed and refuses to talk to you? Teleborian sighed, as though he thought it was irksome to have to explain the obvious. He smiled.
From a patient who sits and says nothing, you can learn only that this is a patient who is good at sitting and saying nothing. Even this is disturbed behaviour, but that's not what I'm basing my conclusions on.
Later this afternoon, I will call upon another psychiatrist. His name is Svante Branden, and he's senior physician at the Institute of Forensic Medicine and a specialist in forensic psychiatry. Do you know him? Teleborian felt confident again. He had expected Janini to call upon another psychiatrist to question his own conclusions. It was a situation for which he was ready and in which he would be able to dismiss every objection without difficulty. Indeed, it would be easier to handle an academic colleague in a friendly debate than someone like Advocate Janini, who had no inhibitions and was bent on distorting his words. He smiled.
He is a highly respected and skilled forensic psychiatrist. But you must understand, Fru Janini, that producing a report of this type is an academic and scientific process. You may disagree with my conclusions, and another psychiatrist may interpret an action or an event in a different way. You may have dissimilar points of view, or perhaps it would be a question purely of how well one doctor or another knows the patient. He might arrive at a very different conclusion about Lisbeth Salander. That is not at all unusual in psychiatry.
That's not why I'm calling him. He has not met or examined Lisbeth Salander, and he will not be making any evaluations about her mental condition.
Oh, is that so?
I have asked him to read your report and all the documentation you have produced on Lisbeth Salander, and to look at her medical records from St. Stephen's. I have asked him to make an assessment, not about the state of my client's health, but about whether, from a purely scientific point of view, there is adequate foundation for your conclusions in the material you recorded. Teleborian shrugged.
With all due respect, I think I have a better understanding of Lisbeth Salander than any other psychiatrist in the country. I have followed her development since she was 12, and regrettably my conclusions were always confirmed by her actions.
Very well, Giannini said. Then we'll take a look at your conclusions. In your statement, you write that her treatment was interrupted when she was placed with a foster family at the age of 15.
That's correct. It was a serious mistake. If we had been allowed to complete the treatment, we might not be here in this courtroom today.
You mean that if you had had the opportunity to keep her in restraints for another year, she might have become more tractable?
That is unfair.
I do beg your pardon. You cite extensively the report that your doctoral candidate Jesper Lurdemann put together when Lisbeth Salander was about to turn 18. You write that, quote, her self-destructive and antisocial behaviour is confirmed by drug abuse and the promiscuity which she has exhibited since she was discharged from St. Stephen's, unquote. What did you mean by this statement? Teleborian sat in silence for several seconds.
Well, now I'll have to go back a bit. After Lisbeth Salander was discharged from St. Stephen's, she developed, as I had predicted, problems with alcohol and drug abuse. She was repeatedly arrested by the police. A social welfare report also determined that she had had profligate sexual relations with older men and that she was very probably involved in prostitution.
Let's analyze this. You say that she abused alcohol. How often was she intoxicated?
I'm sorry?
Was she drunk every day from when she was released until she turned 18?
Was she drunk once a week? Well, naturally, I can't answer that.
But you have just stated that she had problems with alcohol abuse.
She was a minor and arrested repeatedly by the police for drunkenness.
That's the second time you have said that she was arrested repeatedly. How often did this occur? Was it once a week or once every other week?
It's not a matter of so many individual occasions.
Lisbeth Salander was arrested on two occasions for drunkenness when she was 17. She was so blind drunk that she was taken to the hospital. These are the repeated arrests you refer to. Was she intoxicated on more than these occasions?
I don't know, but one might fear that her behaviour was...
Excuse me, did I hear you correctly? You do not know whether she was intoxicated on more than two occasions during her teenage years, but you fear that this was the case. And yet you write reports maintaining that Lisbeth Salander was engaged in repeated alcohol and drug abuse?
That is the social services information, not mine. It has to do with Lisbeth Salander's whole lifestyle. Not surprisingly, her prognosis was dismal after her treatment was interrupted, and her life became a round of alcohol abuse, police intervention, and uncontrolled promiscuity.
You say uncontrolled promiscuity?
Yes. That's a term which indicates that she had no control over her own life. She had sexual relations with older men.
That's not against the law.
No, but it's abnormal behaviour for a 17-year-old girl. The question might be asked as to whether she participated in such encounters of her own free will, or whether she was in a situation of uncontrollable compulsion.
But you said that she was very probably a prostitute.
That may have been a natural consequence of the fact that she lacked education, was incapable of completing school or continuing on to higher education, and therefore could not get a job. It's possible that she viewed older men as father figures, and that financial remuneration for sexual favours was simply a convenient bonus, in which case I perceive it as neurotic behaviour.
So you think that a 17-year-old girl who has sex is neurotic?
You're twisting my words.
But you do not know whether she ever took money for sexual favours.
She was never arrested for prostitution.
And she hardly could be, since prostitution is not a crime in our country.
Well, yes, that's right. In her case, this has to do with compulsive neurotic behaviour.
And you did not hesitate to conclude that Lisbeth Salander is mentally ill based on these unverifiable assumptions? When I was 16 years old, I drank myself silly on half a bottle of vodka which I stole from my father. Do you think that makes me mentally ill?
No, of course not.
If I may be so bold, is it not a fact that when you were 17, you went to a party and got so drunk that you and your friends went out on the town and smashed the windows around the square in Uppsala? You were arrested by the police, detained until you were sober, and then let off with a fine." Teleborian looked shocked. "Is that not a fact, Dr. Teleborian?"
"Well, yes. People do so many stupid things when they're 17, but
that doesn't lead you, or anyone else, to believe that you have a serious mental illness?" Teleborian was angry. That infernal lawyer kept twisting his words and homing in on details. She refused to see the larger picture. And his own childish escapade. How the hell had she gotten a hold of that information? He cleared his throat and spoke in a raised voice.
"The reports from social services were unequivocal. They confirmed that Lisbeth Salander had a lifestyle that revolved around alcohol, drugs, and promiscuity. Social services also said that she was a prostitute."
"No. Social services never said that she was a prostitute.
She was arrested at..."
"No, she was not arrested," Giannini said. "She was searched in Tantolunden at the age of 17, when she was in the company of a much older man. That same year she was arrested for drunkenness, also in the company of a much older man. Social services feared that she might be engaged in prostitution, but no evidence was ever presented."
"She had very loose sexual relations with a large number of individuals, both male and female."
"In your own report you dwell on my client's sexual habits. You claim that her relationship with her friend Miriam Wu confirms the misgivings about a sexual psychopathy. Why does it confirm any such thing?" Teleborian gave no answer. "I sincerely hope that you are not thinking of claiming that homosexuality is a mental illness," Giannini said. "That might even be an illegal statement."
"No, of course not. I'm alluding to the elements of sexual sadism in the relationship."
"You think that she's a sadist?"
We
have Miriam Wu's statement here. There was, it says, no violence in their relationship.
They engaged in S&M sex, and
now I'm beginning to think you've been reading too many evening newspapers. Lisbeth Salander and her friend Miriam Wu engaged in sexual games on some occasions, which involved Miriam Wu tying up my client and giving her sexual satisfaction. That is neither especially unusual or against the law. Is that why you want to lock up my client?" Teleborian waved a hand in a dismissive gesture. "When I was 16 and still at school, I was intoxicated on a good many occasions. I have tried drugs, I have smoked marijuana, and I even tried cocaine on one occasion about 20 years ago. I had my first sexual experience with a school friend when I was 15, and I had a relationship with a boy who tied my hands to the bedposts when I was 20. When I was 22, I had a relationship with a man who was 47 that lasted several months. Am I, in your view, mentally ill?"
"Fru Giannini, you joke about this, but your sexual experiences are irrelevant in this case."
"Why is that?" "When I read your so-called psychiatric assessment of Lisbeth Salander, I find point after point which, taken out of context, would apply to myself. Why am I healthy and sound, while Lisbeth Salander is considered a dangerous sadist?"
"These are not the details that are relevant. You didn't twice try to murder your father."
"Dr. Teleborian, the reality is that it's none of your business whom Lisbeth Salander wants to have sex with. It's none of your business which gender her partner is, or how they conduct their sexual relations. And yet in her case you pluck out details from her life and use them as the basis for saying that she is sick."
"Lisbeth Salander's whole life, from the time she was in junior school, is a document of unprovoked and violent outbursts of anger against teachers and other pupils."
"Just a moment." Giannini's voice was suddenly like an ice scraper on a car window. "Look at my client." Everyone looked at Salander. "My client grew up in abominable family circumstances. Over a period of years, her father persistently abused her mother."
"That's..."
"Let me finish. Lisbeth Salander's mother was mortally afraid of Alexander Zalichenko. She did not dare to protest. She did not dare to go to a doctor. She did not dare to go to a women's crisis center. She was ground down and eventually beaten so badly that she suffered irreversible brain damage. The person who had to take responsibility, the only person who tried to take responsibility for the family long before she reached her teens even, was Lisbeth Salander. She had to shoulder that burden all by herself, since Zalachenko the spy was more important to the state and its social services than Lisbeth's mother. The result was a situation in which society abandoned Lisbeth's mother and her two children. Are you surprised that Lisbeth had problems at school? Look at her. She's small and skinny. She has always been the smallest girl in her class. She was introverted and eccentric, and she had no friends. Do you know how children tend to treat fellow students who are different? Teleborian sighed. Giannini continued. I can go back to her school records and examine one situation after another in which Lisbeth turned violent. The incidents were always preceded by some kind of provocation. I can easily recognize the signs of bullying. Let me tell you something.
What?
I admire Lisbeth Salander. She's tougher than I am. If I had been strapped down for a year when I was 13, I would probably have broken down altogether. She fought back with the only weapon she had available, her contempt for you. Her nervousness was long gone. She felt that she was in control. In your testimony this morning, you spoke a great deal about fantasies. You stated, for instance, that Lisbeth Salander's account of her rape by Advocate Buhrmann is a fantasy.
That's correct.
On what do you base your conclusion?
On my experience of the way she usually fantasizes.
On your experience of the way she usually fantasizes? How do you decide when she is fantasizing? When she says that she was strapped to a bed for 380 days and nights, in your opinion it's a fantasy, despite the fact that your very own records tell us that this was indeed the case.
This is something entirely different. There is not a shred of evidence that Buhrmann committed rape against Lisbeth Salander. I mean, needles through her nipples and such gross violence that she unquestionably should have been taken by ambulance to the hospital. It's obvious that this could not have taken place.
Giannini turned to Judge Everson. I asked to have a projector available today.
It's in place, the judge said.
Could we close the curtains, please? Giannini opened her power book and plugged in the cables to the projector. She turned to her client. Lisbeth, we're going to look at the film. Are you ready for this?
I've lived through it, Salander said dryly.
And I have your approval to show it here?
Salander nodded. She fixed her eyes on Teleborian.
Can you tell us when the film was made?
On March 7th, 2003.
Who shot the film?
I did. I used a hidden camera, standard equipment at Milton Security.
Just one moment, Prosecutor Ekstrom shouted. This is beginning to resemble a circus act.
What is it we are about to see? Judge Everson said, with a sharp edge to his voice.
Dr. Teleborian claims that Lisbeth Salander's account of her rape by Advocate Buhrmann is a fantasy. I'm going to show you evidence to the contrary. The film is 90 minutes long, but I will show only a few short excerpts. I'll warn you that it contains some very unpleasant scenes.
Is this some sort of trick? Ekstrom said.
There's a good way to find out, said Giannini, and started the DVD in her laptop.
Haven't you even learned to tell the time? Advocate Buhrmann greets Salander gruffly.
The camera enters his apartment. After 9 minutes, Judge Everson banged his gavel. Advocate Buhrmann was being shown violently shoving a dildo into Lisbeth Salander's anus. Giannini had turned up the volume. Salander's half-stifled screams through the duct tape that covered her mouth were heard throughout the courtroom.
"Turn off the film!" Judge Everson said, in a very loud and commanding voice.
Giannini pressed stop and the ceiling lights were turned back on. Judge Everson was red in the face. Prosecutor Ekstrom sat as if turned to stone. Teleborian was as pale as a corpse.
Advocate Giannini, how long is this film, did you say?
90 minutes.
The rape itself went on in stages for about 5 or 6 hours, but my client has only a vague sense of the violence inflicted upon her in the last few hours.
Giannini turned to Teleborian.
There is a scene, however, in which Buhrmann pushes a needle through my client's nipple, something that Dr. Teleborian maintains is an expression of Lisbeth Salander's wild imagination. It takes place in minute 72, and I'm offering to show the episode here and now.
Thank you, that won't be necessary,
the judge said.
Fröken Salander.
For a second he lost his train of thought, and did not know how to proceed.
Fröken Salander, why did you record this film?
Bjurman had already subjected me to one rape and was demanding more. The first time he made me blow him, the old creep. I thought it was going to be a repeat. I thought I'd be able to get such good evidence of what he did that I could then blackmail him into staying away from me. I misjudged him.
But why did you not go to the police when you have such irrefutable evidence?
I don't talk to policemen, Salander said flatly.
Palmgren stood up from his wheelchair. He supported himself by leaning on the edge of the table. His voice was very clear.
Our client, on principle, does not speak to the police or to other persons of authority, and least of all to psychiatrists. The reason is simple. From the time she was a child, she tried time and again to talk to police and social workers to explain that her mother was being abused by Alexander Zalachenko. The result in every instance was that she was punished because government civil servants had decided that Zalachenko was more important than she was.
He cleared his throat and continued.
And when she eventually concluded that nobody was listening to her, her only means of protecting her mother was to fight Zalachenko with violence. And then this bastard who calls himself a doctor,
he pointed at Teleborian,
wrote a fabricated psychiatric diagnosis which described her as mentally ill, and it gave him the opportunity to keep her in restraints at St. Stephen's for 380 days. What a bastard!
Palmgren sat down. Judge Everson was surprised by this outburst. He turned to Salander.
Would you perhaps like to take a break?
Why? Salander said.
All right. Then we'll continue. Advocate Giannini, the recording will be examined, and I will require a technical opinion to verify its authenticity. But I cannot tolerate seeing any more of these appalling scenes at present. Let's proceed.
Gladly. I too find them appalling, said Giannini. My client has been subjected to multiple instances of physical and mental abuse and legal misconduct, and the person most to blame for this is Dr. Peter Teleborian. He betrayed his oath as a physician and he betrayed his patient. Together with a member of an illegal group within the security police, Gunnar Bjork, he patched together a forensic psychiatric assessment for the purpose of locking up an inconvenient witness. I believe that this case must be unique in Swedish jurisprudence.
These are outrageous accusations, Teleborian said. I have done my best to help Lisbeth Salander. She tried to murder her father. It's perfectly obvious that there's something wrong with her,
Giannini interrupted him.
I would now like to bring to the attention of the court Dr. Teleborian's second forensic psychiatric assessment of my client, presented at this trial today. I maintain that it is a lie, just as the report from 1991 was a lie.
Well, this is simply...
Teleborian spluttered.
Judge Everson, could you please ask the witness to stop interrupting me?
Here, Teleborian, I will be quiet. But these are outrageous accusations. It's not surprising that I'm upset. Here, Teleborian, please be quiet until a question is directed to you. Go on, Advocate Giannini.
This is the forensic psychiatric assessment that Dr. Teleborian has presented to the court. It is based on what he has termed observations of my client, which were supposed to have taken place after she was moved to Kronoberg prison on June 5th. The examination was supposed to have been concluded on July 5th.
Yes, so I have understood,
Judge Everson said.
Dr. Teleborian, is it the case that you did not have the opportunity to examine or observe my client before June 6th? Before that, she was at Sahlgrenska Hospital in Göteborg, where she was being kept in isolation, as we know.
Yes.
You made attempts on two separate occasions to gain access to my client at Sahlgrenska. Both times you were denied admittance.
Giannini opened her briefcase and took out a document. She walked around her table and handed it to Judge Everson.
I see,
the judge said.
This appears to be a copy of Dr. Teleborian's report. What is your point?
I would like to call two witnesses. They're waiting outside the courtroom now.
Who are these witnesses?
They are Mikhail Blomqvist from Millennium Magazine and Superintendent Torsten Edklinth, Director of the Constitutional Protection Unit of the Security Police.
And they are outside?
Yes.
Show them in, Judge Everson said. This is highly irregular, Prosecutor Ekstrom said.
Ekstrom had watched in extreme discomfort as Giannini shredded his key witness. The film was devastating evidence. The judge ignored Ekstrom and gestured to the bailiff to open the door to admit Blomqvist and Edklinth.
I would first like to call Mikhail Blomqvist.
Then I would ask that Herr Teleborian stand down for a while,
Judge Everson said.
Are you finished with me?
Teleborian said.
No, not by any means, Giannini said.
Blomqvist replaced Teleborian in the witness box. Judge Everson swiftly dealt with the formalities and Blomqvist took the oath.
Mikhail, Giannini said, and then she smiled. I would find it difficult, if Your Honour will forgive me, to call my brother Herr Blomqvist, so I will settle for his first name.
She went to Judge Everson's bench and asked for the forensic psychiatric report which she had just handed to him. She then gave it to Blomqvist.
Have you seen this document before?
Yes, I have. I have three versions in my possession. The first I acquired on May 12th, the second on May 19th, and the third, this one, on June 3rd.
Can you tell us how you acquired the copies?
I received them in my capacity as a journalist, from a source I do not intend to name.
Salander stared at Teleborian. He was once more deathly pale.
What did you do with the report?
I gave it to Torsten Edklinth at Constitutional Protection.
Thank you, Mika. Now I'd like to call Torsten Edklinth, Giannini said, taking back the report.
She handed it to Judge Everson, and the procedure with the oath was repeated.
Superintendent Edklinth, is it correct that you received a forensic psychiatric report on Lisbeth Salander from Mikhail Blomqvist?
Yes, it is.
When did you receive it?
It was logged in at SIS on June 4th.
And this is the same report I've just handed to Judge Everson?
If my signature is on the back, then it's the same one.
The judge turned over the document and saw Edklinth's signature there.
Superintendent Edklinth, could you explain how you happened to have a forensic psychiatric report in your possession which claims to have analysed a patient who was still in isolation at Salgrenska?
Yes, I can. Dr. Teleborian's report is a sham. It was put together with the help of a person by the name of Jonas Sandberg, just as he produced a similar document in 1991 with Gunnar Björk. That's a lie, Teleborian said in a weak voice.
Is it a lie? Giannini said.
No, not at all, Edklinth said. I should perhaps mention that Jonas Sandberg is one of a dozen or so individuals who were arrested today by order of the Prosecutor General. Sandberg is being held as an accomplice to the murder of Gunnar Björk. He is part of a criminal unit operating within the security police, which has been protecting Alexander Zarechenko since the 70s. This same group of officers was responsible for the decision to lock up Lisbeth Salander in 1991. We have incontrovertible evidence as well as a confession from the unit's director.
The courtroom was hushed, transfixed.
Would Dr. Teleborian like to comment on what has just been said?
Judge Everson asked.
Teleborian shook his head. In that case, it is my duty to tell you that you risk being charged with perjury and possibly other counts in addition, Judge Everson said.
If you'll excuse me, Your Honour, Blomqvist said.
Yes?
Dr. Teleborian has bigger problems than this. Outside the courtroom are two police officers who would like to bring him in for questioning.
I see, the judge said. Is it a matter which concerns this court?
I believe it is, Your Honour.
Judge Everson gestured to the bailiff, who admitted Inspector Modig and a woman Prosecutor Ekstrom did not immediately recognise. Her name was Lisa Kolschow, and she was a criminal inspector for the Special Investigations Division, the unit within the National Police Board responsible for investigating cases of child pornography and sexual assault on children.
And what is your business here?
Judge Everson said.
We are here to arrest Peter Teleborian with your permission and without wishing to disturb the court's proceedings.
Judge Everson looked at Advocate Giannini.
I'm not quite finished with him, but the court may have heard enough of Dr. Teleborian.
You have my permission,
Judge Everson said to the police officers. Kolshue walked across to Teleborian.
Peter Teleborian, you are under arrest for violation of the law on child pornography.
Teleborian sat still, hardly breathing. Giannini saw that all the light in his eyes seemed to have been extinguished.
Specifically, for possession of approximately 9,000 pornographic photographs of children found on your computer.
She bent down to pick up his laptop, which he had brought with him.
This is confiscated as evidence, she said.
As he was being led from the courtroom, Salander's blazing eyes bored into Teleborian's back. Chapter 28. Friday, July 15th, to Saturday, July 16th. Judge Everson tapped his pen on the edge of his table to quell the murmuring that had arisen in the wake of Teleborian's departure. He seemed unsure how to proceed. Then he turned to Prosecutor Ekstrom.
Do you have any comment to make to the court on what has been seen and heard in the past hour?
Ekstrom stood up and looked at Judge Everson, and then at Edlinth, before he turned his head and met Salander's unwavering gaze. He understood that the battle was lost. He glanced over at Blomqvist and realized with sudden terror that he too risked being exposed to Millennium's investigators, which could ruin his career. He was at a loss to comprehend how this had happened. He had come to the trial convinced that he knew everything about the case. He had understood the delicate balance sought by national security after his many candid talks with Superintendent Nystrom. It had been explained to him that the Salander report from 1991 had been fabricated. He had received the inside information he needed. He had asked questions, hundreds of them, and received answers to all of them, a deception in the national interest. And now Nystrom had been arrested, according to Edlinth. He had believed in Teleborian, who had, after all, seemed so competent, so convincing.
Good Lord, what sort of a mess have I landed in?
And then, how the hell am I going to get out of it? He stroked his goatee. He cleared his throat. Slowly he removed his glasses.
I regret to say that it seems I have been misinformed on a number of essential points in this investigation.
He wondered if he could shift the blame onto the police investigators. Then he had a vision of Inspector Bublansky. Bublansky would never back him up. If Ekstrom made one wrong move, Bublansky would call a press conference and sink him. Ekstrom met Salander's gaze. She was sitting there patiently, and in her eyes he read both curiosity and vengeance. No compromises. He could still get her convicted of aggravated assault in Stallarholmen, and he could probably get her convicted for the aggravated assault and attempted murder of her father in Gossaberger. That would mean changing his strategy immediately. He would drop everything that had anything to do with Teleborian. All claims that she was a psychopath had to go, but that meant that her story would be strengthened all the way back to 1991. The whole declaration of incompetence was bogus, and with that, plus she has that blasted film. Then it struck him. Good God, she's a victim, pure and simple.
Judge Everson, I believe I can no longer rely on the documents I have here in my hand.
I suppose not, Judge Everson said.
I'm going to have to ask for a recess, or that the trial be suspended until I am able to make certain adjustments to my case.
Advocate Giannini, the judge said.
I request that my client be at once acquitted on all counts and be released immediately. I also request that the district court take a definite position on the question of Fröken Salander's declaration of incompetence. Moreover, I believe that she should be adequately compensated for the violations of her rights that have occurred.
Lisbeth Salander turned towards Judge Everson. No compromises. Judge Everson looked at Salander's autobiography. He then looked over at Prosecutor Ekstrom.
I, too, believe we would be wise to investigate exactly what has happened that brings us to this sorry pass. I fear that you are probably not the right person to conduct that investigation.
In all my years as a jurist and judge, I have never been party to anything even approaching the legal dilemma in this case. I confess that I am at a loss for words. I have never even heard of a case in which the prosecutor's chief witness is arrested during a court in session, or of a convincing argument turning out to be an utter fabrication. I honestly do not see what is left of the prosecutor's case.
Palmgren cleared his throat.
Yes, Everson said.
As a representative for the defence, I can only share your feelings. Sometimes one must step back and allow common sense to guide the formal procedures. I'd like to state that you, in your capacity as judge, have seen only the first stage of a scandal that is going to rock the whole establishment. Today, 12 police officers from within Seppo have been arrested. They will be charged with murder, and a list of crimes so long that it will take quite some time to draw up the report.
I presume that I must decide on a suspension of this trial.
If you'll excuse me for saying so, I think that would be an unfortunate decision.
I'm listening.
Lisbeth Salander is innocent. Her fantastical autobiography, as Dr. Teleborian so contemptuously dismissed it, is in fact true. And it can all be proven. She has suffered an outrageous violation of her rights. As a court, we could now stick with formal procedure and continue with the trial until finally we arrive at an acquittal. But there is an obvious alternative: to let a new investigation take over everything concerning Lisbeth Salander. An investigation is already underway to sort out an integral part of this mess.
I see what you mean.
As the judge of this case, you have a choice. The wise thing to do would be to reject the prosecutor's entire preliminary investigation and request that he do his homework.
Judge Everson looked long and hard at Ekstrom.
The just thing to do would be to acquit my client at once. She also deserves an apology. But the redress will take time and will depend upon the rest of the investigation.
I understand the point you're making, Advocate Palmgren. But before I can declare your client innocent, I will have to have the whole story clear in my mind. That will probably take a while.
He hesitated and looked at Giannini.
If I decide that the court will adjourn until Monday and accommodate your wishes insofar as I see no reason to keep your client in custody any longer, which would mean that you could expect that no matter what else happens, she will not be given a prison sentence, can you guarantee that she will appear for continued proceedings when summoned?
Of course, Palmgren said quickly.
No, Salander said in a sharp voice. Everyone's eyes turned to the person who was at the heart of the entire drama.
What do you mean by that? Judge Everson said.
The moment you release me, I'm going to leave the country. I do not intend to spend one more minute of my time on this trial.
You would refuse to appear?
That is correct. If you want me to answer more questions, then you'll have to keep me in prison. The moment you release me, this story is settled as far as I'm concerned. And that does not include being available for an indefinite time to you, to Ekstrom, or to any police officers.
Judge Everson sighed. Palmgren looked bewildered.
I agree with my client, Giannini said. It is the government and the authorities who have committed crimes against Lisbeth Salander, not the other way around. At the very least, she deserves to be able to walk out that door with an acquittal and the chance to put this whole story behind her.
No compromises.
Judge Everson glanced at his watch. It is 3. That means that you're going to force me to keep your client in custody.
If that's your decision, then we accept it. As Froken Salander's representative, I request that she be acquitted of the charges brought by Prosecutor Ekstrom. I request that you release my client without restrictions and without delay. And I request that the previous declaration of incompetence be rescinded and that her civil rights be immediately restored.
The matter of the declaration of incompetence is a significantly longer process. I would have to get statements from psychiatric experts after she has been examined. I cannot simply make a snap decision about that.
We do not accept that, Giannini said.
Why not?
Lisbeth Salander must have the same civil rights as any other citizen of Sweden. She has been the victim of a crime. She was falsely declared incompetent. We have heard evidence of that falsification. The decision to place her under guardianship therefore lacks a legal basis and must be unconditionally rescinded. There is no reason whatsoever for my client to submit to a psychiatric examination. No one else has to prove that they are not mentally ill if they are the victim of a crime.
Judge Everson considered the matter for a moment.
Advocate Giannini, I realize that this is an exceptional situation. I'm calling a recess of 15 minutes so that we can stretch our legs and gather our thoughts. I have no wish that your client be kept in custody tonight if she is innocent. But that means that this trial will have to continue today until we are done.
That sounds good to me, said Giannini.
Blomqvist hugged his sister.
How did it go?
Mikhail, I was brilliant against Teleborian. I annihilated him.
I told you you'd be unbeatable.
When it comes down to it, this story is not primarily about spies and secret government agencies. It's about violence against women and the men who enable it. From what little I heard and saw, you were phenomenal. She's going to be acquitted.
You're right. There's no longer any doubt.
Judge Everson banged his gavel.
Could you please sum up the facts from beginning to end, so that I can get a clear picture of what actually happened?
Let's begin, Giannini said, with the astounding story of a group within the security police who call themselves the Section, and who got a hold of a Soviet defector in the mid-70s. The story was published today in Millennium Magazine. I imagine it will be the lead story on all the news broadcasts this evening.
At 6 that evening, Judge Everson decided to release Salander and to revoke her declaration of incompetence. But the decision was made on one condition. Judge Everson demanded that Salander submit to an interview in which she would formally testify to her knowledge of the Zalochenko affair. At first, she refused. This refusal brought about a moment's wrangling until Judge Everson raised his voice. He leaned forward and fixed his gaze on Salander.
Fröken Salander, if I rescind your declaration of incompetence, that will mean that you have exactly the same rights as all other citizens. It also means that you have the same obligations. It is therefore your duty to manage your finances, pay taxes, obey the law, and assist the police in investigations of serious crimes. So I am summoning you to be questioned like any other citizen who has information that might be vital to an investigation.
The force of this logic seemed to sink in. She pouted and looked angry, but she stopped arguing.
When the police have interviewed you, the leader of the preliminary investigation, in this case the Prosecutor General, will decide whether you will be summoned as a witness in any future legal proceedings. Like any other Swedish citizen, you can refuse to obey such a summons. How you act is none of my concern, but you do not have carte blanche. If you refuse to appear, then like any other adult, you may be charged with obstruction of justice or perjury. There are no exceptions.
Salander's expression darkened even more.
So what is your decision? Judge Everson said.
After thinking it over for a minute, Salander gave a curt nod. Okay. A little compromise. During her summary of the Zalochenko affair that evening, Giannini launched a savage attack on Prosecutor Ekström. Eventually, Ekström admitted that the course of events had proceeded more or less as Giannini had described. He had been helped during the preliminary investigation by Superintendent Nyström, and he had received his information from Dr. Teleborian. In Ekström's case, there was no conspiracy. He had gone along with the Section in good faith in his capacity as leader of the preliminary investigation. When the whole extent of the conspiracy finally dawned on him, he decided to withdraw all charges against Salander, and that decision meant that a raft of bureaucratic formalities could be set aside. Judge Everson looked relieved. Palmgren was exhausted after his day in court, the first in many years. He needed to go back to the Esther Rehabilitation Home and go to bed. He was driven there by a uniformed guard from Milton Security. As he was leaving, he put a hand on Salander's shoulder. They looked at each other, saying nothing. After a moment, she nodded.
Giannini called Blomqvist at 7 to tell him that Salander had been acquitted of all charges, but that she was going to have to stay at police headquarters for what might be another couple of hours for her interview. The news came as the entire staff of Millennium was gathered at the office. The phones had been ringing incessantly since the first copies of the magazine had been distributed by messenger at lunchtime to other newsrooms across the city. In the early evening, TV4 had broadcast its first special program on Zalachenko and the Section. The media was having a field day. Blomqvist walked into the main office, stuck his fingers in his mouth, and gave a loud whistle.
"Great news! Salander has been acquitted on all counts!"
Spontaneous applause broke out. Then everyone went back to talking on their phones as if nothing had happened. Blomqvist looked up at the television that had been turned on in the editorial office. The news on TV4 was just starting. The trailer was a brief clip of the film showing Sandberg planting cocaine in his apartment on Bellmansgarten. "Here we can clearly see a SEPO officer planting what we later learn is cocaine at the apartment of Mikhail Blomqvist, journalist at Millennium Magazine." Then the anchorman came on the screen. 12 officers of the security police were today arrested on a range of criminal charges, including murder. Welcome to this extended news broadcast." Blomqvist turned off the sound when she came on, and he saw himself sitting in a studio armchair. He already knew what he had said. He looked over at the desk where Svensson had sat. All his research documents on the sex trafficking industry were gone, and the desk was once more home to stacks of newspapers and piles of unsorted paper that nobody had time to deal with. For Blomqvist, it was at that desk that the Zalachenko affair had begun. He wished that Svensson had been able to see the conclusion of it. A pile of copies of his just-published book was on the table next to Blomqvist's own about the Section.
"You would have loved this moment, Doug."
He heard the phone in his office ringing, but he could not face picking it up. He pulled the door shut and went into Berger's office and sank into a comfortable chair by the window. Berger was on the phone. He looked around. She had been back a month but had not yet had a chance to put up the paintings and photographs she had taken away when she left in April. The bookshelves were still bare.
"How does it feel?" she said when she hung up.
"I think I'm happy," he said.
She laughed.
"The Section is going to be a sensation. Every newsroom is going crazy for it. Do you feel like appearing on Aktuelt at 9 for an interview?"
"I think not."
"I suspected as much."
"We're going to be talking about this for several months. There's no rush."
She nodded.
"What are you doing later this evening?" Berger said.
"I don't know."
He bit his lip.
"Erika, I..."
"Figueroa,"
Berger said with a smile. He nodded.
"So it's serious?"
"I don't know."
"She's in love with you."
"I think I'm in love with her too," he said.
"I promise I'll keep my distance until, you know. Well, maybe," she said.
At 8, Armansky and Linda appeared at Millennium's offices. They thought the occasion called for champagne, so they had brought over a crate from the liquor store. Berger hugged Linda and introduced her to everyone. Armansky took a seat in Blomqvist's office. They drank their champagne. Neither of them said anything for quite a while. It was Armansky who broke the silence.
"You know what, Blomqvist? The first time we met on that job in Hedestad, I didn't much care for you."
"You don't say."
"You came over to sign a contract when you hired Lisbeth as a researcher."
"I remember."
"I think I was jealous of you. You'd known her only a couple of hours, yet she was laughing with you. For some years I tried to be Elizabeth's friend, but I have never once made her smile."
"Well, I haven't really been that successful either."
They sat in silence once again.
"Great that all this is over," Armansky said.
"Amen to that," Blomqvist said,
and they raised their glasses in salute. Inspectors Bublansky and Murdig conducted the formal interview with Salander. They had both been at home with their families after a particularly taxing day, but were immediately summoned to return to police headquarters. Salander was accompanied by Giannini. She gave precise responses to all the questions that Bublansky and Murdig asked, and Giannini had little occasion to comment or intervene. Salander lied consistently on 2 points. In her description of what had happened in Stalaholmen, she stubbornly maintained that it was Niemanen who had accidentally shot Maga Lundin in the foot at the instant that she nailed him with a taser. Where had she gotten the taser?
She had confiscated it from Lundin, she explained. Boblansky and Modig were both sceptical, but there was no evidence and no witnesses to contradict her story. Niemannen was no doubt in a position to protest, but he refused to say anything about the incident. In fact, he had no notion of what had happened in the seconds after he was stunned with the taser. As far as Salander's journey to Gossaberger was concerned, she claimed that her only objective had been to convince her father to turn himself in to the police. Salander looked completely guileless. It was impossible to say whether she was telling the truth or not. Giannini had no reason to arrive at an opinion on the matter. The only person who knew for certain that Salander had gone to Gossaberger with the intention of terminating any relationship she had with her father once and for all was Blomqvist. But he had been sent out of the courtroom shortly after the proceedings were resumed. No one knew that he and Salander had carried on long conversations online by night while she was confined to Sahlgrenska. The media missed her release from custody altogether. If the time of it had been known, a huge contingent would have descended on police headquarters, but many of the reporters were exhausted after the chaos and excitement that had ensued when Millennium reached the newsstands and certain members of the security police were arrested by other security police officers. The host of She on TV4 was the only journalist who knew what the story was all about. Her hour-long broadcast became a classic, and some months later she won the award for Best TV News Story of the Year. Modig got Salander away from police headquarters by simply taking her and Giannini down to the garage and driving them to Giannini's office on Kungholm's Kirkoplan. There they switched to Giannini's car. When Modig had driven away, Giannini headed for Södermalm. As they passed the Parliament building, she broke the silence.
"Where to?" she said.
Salander thought for a few seconds.
"You can drop me somewhere on Lundegarten. Miriam isn't there."
Salander looked at her. "She went to France soon after she got out of the hospital. She's staying with her parents if you want to get a hold of her."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"You never asked. She said she needed some space. This morning Mikhail gave me these and said you'd probably like to have them back." She handed her a set of keys. Salander took it and said,
"Thanks. Could you drop me somewhere in Falkengergarten instead?"
"You don't even want to tell me where you live?"
"Later. Right now I want to be left in peace."
"Okay." Giannini had switched on her mobile when they left police headquarters. It started beeping as they were passing Slusen. She looked at the display.
"It's Mikhail. He's called every 10 minutes for the past couple of hours. I don't want to talk to him."
"Tell me.
Can I ask you a personal question?"
"Yes."
"What did Mikhail do to you that you hate him so much? I mean, if it weren't for him, you'd probably be back on a secure ward tonight."
"I don't hate Mikhail. He hasn't done anything to me. I just don't want to see him right now."
Giannini glanced across at her client.
"I don't mean to pry, but you fell for him, didn't you?"
Salander looked out the window and did not answer.
"My brother is completely irresponsible when it comes to relationships. He screws his way through life and doesn't seem to grasp how much it can hurt those women who think of him as more than a casual affair."
Salander met her gaze.
"I don't want to discuss Mikhail with you."
"Right," Giannini said. She pulled over just before the junction with Erstegarten.
"Is this okay?"
"Yes."
They sat in silence for a moment. Salander made no move to open the door. Then Giannini turned off the engine.
"What happens now?"
Salander said at last.
"What happens now is that as of today you are no longer under guardianship. You can live your life however you want. Even though we won in the district court, there's still a ton of red tape to get through.
There will be reports on accountability within the guardianship agency, and the question of compensation and things like that, and the criminal investigations will continue."
"I don't want any compensation. I want to be left in peace."
"I understand. But what you want won't play much of a role here. This process is beyond your control. I suggest you get yourself a lawyer to represent you."
"Don't you want to go on being my lawyer?"
Giannini rubbed her eyes. After all the stress of the day, she felt utterly drained. She wanted to go home and have a shower. She wanted her husband to massage her back.
"I don't know. You don't trust me, and I don't trust you.
I have no desire to be drawn into a long process, during which I encounter nothing but frustrating silence when I make a suggestion or want to discuss something.
Salander said nothing for a long moment.
I'm not good at relationships, but I do trust you.
It sounded almost like an apology.
That may be. And it needn't be my problem if you're bad at relationships, but it does become my problem if I have to represent you.
Silence.
Would you want me to go on being your lawyer?
Salander nodded. Giannini sighed.
I live at Fiskegarten 9, above Mosabeka Torg. Could you drive me there?
Giannini looked at her client and then started the engine. She let Salander direct her to the address. They stopped short of the building.
Okay, Giannini said. We'll give it a try. Here are my conditions. I agree to represent you. When I call you, I want you to answer. When I need to know what you want me to do, I want clear answers. If I call you and tell you that you have to talk to a policeman or a prosecutor, or do anything else that has to do with a criminal investigation, then I have already decided that it's necessary. You will have to turn up at the appointed place, on time, and not make a fuss about it. Can you live with that?
I can.
And if you start acting up, I stop being your lawyer. Understood?
Salander nodded.
One more thing. I don't want to get involved in a big drama between you and my brother. If you have a problem with him, you'll have to work it out. But, for the record, he's not your enemy.
I know. I'll deal with it. But I need some time.
What do you plan to do now?
I don't know. You can reach me via email. I'll promise to reply as soon as I can, but I might not be checking it every day.
You won't become a slave just because you have a lawyer.
Okay, that's enough for the time being. Out you get. I'm dead tired and I want to go home and sleep.
Salander opened the door and got out. She paused as she was about to close the car door. She looked as though she wanted to say something but could not find the words. For a moment, she appeared almost vulnerable.
That's all right, Lisbeth, Giannini said. Go and get some sleep, and stay out of trouble for a while.
Salander stood at the curb and watched Giannini drive away until her taillights disappeared around the corner.
Thanks, she said at last.
Chapter 29. Saturday, July 16th to Friday, October 7th. Salander found her Palm Tungsten T3 on the hall table. Next to it were her car keys and the shoulder bag she had lost when Lundin attacked her outside the door to her apartment building on Lundegarten. She also found both opened and unopened mail that had been collected from her P.O. box on Hornsgarten. Mikael Blomqvist. She took a slow tour through the furnished part of her apartment. She found traces of him everywhere. He had slept in her bed and worked at her desk. He had used her printer, and in the waste paper basket she found drafts of the manuscript of The Section, along with discarded notes. He had bought a quart of milk, bread, cheese, caviar, and a jumbo pack of Billy's Pan Pizza, and put them in the fridge. On the kitchen table she found a small white envelope with her name on it. It was a note from him. The message was brief. His mobile number. That was all. She knew that the ball was in her court. He was not going to get in touch with her. He had finished the story, given back the keys to her apartment, and he would not call her. If she wanted something, then she could call him.
Pig-headed bastard.
She put on a pot of coffee, made 4 open sandwiches, and went to sit in her window seat to look out towards Djurgården. She lit a cigarette and brooded. It was all over. And yet now her life felt more claustrophobic than ever. Miriam Wu had gone to France.
It was my fault that you almost died.
She had shuddered at the thought of having to see Mimi, but had decided that that would be her first stop when she was released. But she had gone to France. All of a sudden she was in debt to people. Palmgren, Armansky. She ought to contact them to say thank you. Paolo Roberto, and Plague, and Trinity. Even those damned police officers, Boblansky and Modig, who had so obviously been in her corner. She did not like feeling beholden to anyone.
She felt like a chess piece in a game she could not control.
Kalle fucking Blomqvist.
And maybe even Erika fucking Berger, with the dimples and the expensive clothes and all that self-assurance. But it was over. Giannini had said so as they left police headquarters. Right. The trial was over. It was over for Giannini, and it was over for Blomqvist. He had published his book and would end up on TV and probably win some fucking prize too. But it was not over for Lisbeth Salander. This was only the first day of the rest of her life. At 4 in the morning she stopped thinking. She discarded her punk outfit on the floor of her bedroom and went to the bathroom and took a shower. She cleaned off all the makeup she had worn in court, put on loose, dark linen pants, a white top and a thin jacket. She packed an overnight bag with a change of underwear and a couple of tops and put on some simple walking shoes. She picked up her palm and called a taxi to collect her from Musabaka Torg. She rode out to Arlanda Airport and arrived just before 6. She studied the departure board and booked a ticket for the morning flight to Malaga. She used her own passport, in her own name. She was surprised that nobody at the ticket desk or at the check-in counter seemed to recognize her or react to her name. She landed in Malaga in the blazing midday heat. She stood inside the terminal building for a moment, feeling uncertain. Then she bought a pair of sunglasses at an airport shop, went out to the taxi stand, and climbed into the back seat of the first taxi.
Gibraltar, I'm paying with a credit card.
The trip took 3 hours via the new motorway along the coast. The taxi dropped her off at British Passport Control, and she walked across the border and over to the Rock Hotel on Europa Road, part way up the slope of the 1,398-foot monolith. She asked if there was a room and was told there was a double room available. She booked it for 2 weeks and handed over her credit card. She showered and sat on the balcony, wrapped up in a bath towel, looking out over the Straits of Gibraltar. She could see freighters and a few yachts. She could just make out Morocco in the haze on the other side of the straits. It was peaceful. After a while she went in and lay down and slept. The next morning Salander woke at 5. She got up, showered, and had a coffee in the hotel bar on the ground floor. At 7 she left the hotel and set out to buy mangoes and apples. She took a taxi to the peak and walked over to the apes. She was so early that few tourists had yet appeared, and she was practically alone with the animals. She liked Gibraltar. It was her third visit to the strange rock that housed an absurdly densely populated English town on the Mediterranean. Gibraltar was a place that was not like anywhere else. The town had been isolated for decades, a colony that obstinately refused to be incorporated into Spain. The Spaniards protested the occupation, of course, but Salander thought that the Spaniards should keep their mouths shut on that score, so long as they occupied the enclave of Ceuta, a Moroccan territory across the straits. It was a place that was comically shielded from the rest of the world, consisting of a bizarre rock, about 3/4 of a square mile of town, and an airport that began and ended in the sea. The colony was so small that every square inch of it was used, and any expansion had to be over the sea. Even to get into the town, visitors had to walk across the landing strip at the airport. Gibraltar gave the concept of compact living a whole new meaning. Salander watched a big male ape climb up onto a wall next to the path. He glowered at her. He was a Barbary ape. She knew better than to try to stroke any of the animals.
"Hello, friend," she said. "I'm back."
The first time she visited Gibraltar, she had not even heard about these apes. She had gone up to the top just to look at the view, and she was surprised when she followed some tourists and found herself in the midst of a group of apes climbing and scrambling on both sides of the pathway. It was a peculiar feeling to be walking along a path and suddenly have 2 dozen apes around you. She looked at them with great wariness. They were not dangerous or aggressive, but they were certainly capable of giving you a bad bite if they got agitated or felt threatened. She found one of the guards and showed him her bag of fruit and asked if she could give it to the apes. He said it was okay. She took out a mango and put it on the wall a little way away from the male ape.
"Breakfast," she said,
leaning against the wall and taking a bite of an apple. The male ape stared at her, bared his teeth, and contentedly picked up the mango. In the middle of the afternoon, 5 days later, Salander fell off her stool in Harry's Bar on a side street off Main Street, 2 blocks from her hotel. She had been drunk almost continuously since she left the Apes on the Rock, and most of her drinking had been done with Harry O'Connell, who owned the bar and spoke with a phony Irish accent, having never in his life set foot in Ireland. He had been watching her anxiously. When she had ordered her first drink several days earlier, he had asked to see her ID. Her name was Lisbeth, he knew, and he called her Liz. She would come in after lunch and sit on a high stool at the far end of the bar with her back against the wall. Then she would drink an impressive number of beers or shots of whiskey. When she drank beer, she did not care what brand or type it was. She accepted whatever he served her. When she ordered whiskey, she always chose Tullamore Dew, except on one occasion, when she studied the bottles behind the bar and asked for Lagavulin. When the glass was brought to her, she sniffed at it, stared at it for a moment, and then took a tiny sip. She set down her glass and stared at it for a minute, with an expression that seemed to indicate that she considered its contents to be a mortal enemy. Finally, she pushed the glass aside and asked Harry to give her something that could not be used to tar a boat. He poured her another Tullamore Dew, and she went back to her drinking. Over the past 4 days, she had consumed almost a whole bottle. He had not kept track of the beers. Harry was surprised that a young woman with her slender build could hold so much. But he took the view that if she wanted alcohol, she was going to get it, whether in his bar or somewhere else. She drank slowly, did not talk to any of the other customers, and did not make any trouble. Her only activity, apart from the consumption of alcohol, seemed to be to play with a handheld computer which she connected to a mobile now and then. He had several times tried to start a conversation, but was met with a sullen silence. She seemed to avoid company. Sometimes, when there were too many people in the bar, she moved outside to a table on the sidewalk, and at other times she went 2 doors down to an Italian restaurant and had dinner. And then she would come back to Harry's and order another Tullamore Dew. She usually left the bar at around 10 and made her way unsteadily off, always to the north. Today she had drunk more, and at a faster rate than on the other days, and Harry had kept a watchful eye on her. When she had put away 7 glasses of Tullamore Dew in a little over 2 hours, he decided not to give her any more. It was then that he heard the crash as she fell off the barstool. He put down the glass he was drying and went around the counter to pick her up. She seemed offended.
"I think you've had enough, Liz," he said.
She looked at him bleary-eyed.
"I believe you're right,"
she said in a surprisingly lucid voice. She held on to the bar with one hand as she dug some notes out of her top pocket and then wobbled off towards the door. He took her gently by the shoulder.
"Hold on a minute. Why don't you go to the toilet and throw up the last of that whiskey and then sit at the bar for a while? I don't want to let you go in this condition."
She did not object when he led her to the toilet. She stuck her fingers down her throat. When she came back out to the bar, he had poured her a large glass of club soda. She drank the whole glass and burped. He poured her another.
"You're going to feel like death in the morning," Harry said.
She nodded.
"That's none of my business. But if I were you, I'd sober up for a couple of days."
She nodded. Then she went back to the toilet and threw up again. She stayed at Harry's bar for another hour, until she looked sober enough to be turned loose. She left the bar on unsteady legs, walked down to the airport, and followed the shoreline around the marina. She walked until after 8, when the ground at last stopped swaying under her feet. Then she went back to the hotel. She took the elevator to her room, brushed her teeth and washed her face, changed her clothes and went back down to the hotel bar to order a cup of black coffee and a bottle of mineral water. She sat there, silent and unnoticed, next to a pillar, studying the people in the bar. She saw a couple in their 30s engaged in quiet conversation. The woman was wearing a light-coloured summer dress, and the man was holding her hand under the table. 2 tables away sat a black family, the man with the beginnings of grey at his temples, the woman wearing a lovely, colourful dress in yellow, black and red. They had 2 young children with them. She studied a group of businessmen in white shirts and ties, their jackets hung over the backs of their chairs. They were drinking beer. She saw a group of elderly people, without a doubt American tourists. The men wore baseball caps, polo shirts, and loose-fitting trousers. She watched a man in a light-coloured linen jacket, grey shirt and dark tie come in from the street and pick up his room key at the front desk before he headed over to the bar and ordered a beer. He sat down 9 feet away from her. She gave him an expectant look as he took out his mobile and began to speak in German.
"Hello? Is that you? Is everything all right? It's going fine.
We're having our next meeting tomorrow afternoon. No, I think it'll work out. I'll be staying here 5 or 6 days at least, and then I go to Madrid. No, I won't be home before the end of next week.
Me too. I love you.
Sure. I'll call you later in the week. Kiss, kiss.
He was a little over 6 feet tall, about 50 years old, maybe 55, with blonde hair that was turning grey and was a bit on the long side, a weak chin and too much weight around the middle, but still reasonably well preserved. He was reading the Financial Times. When he finished his beer and headed for the elevator, Salander got up and followed him. He pushed the button for the 6th floor. Salander stood next to him and leaned her head against the side of the elevator.
"I'm drunk," she said.
He smiled down at her.
"Oh, really?"
"It's been one of those weeks. Let me guess. You're a businessman of some sort, from Hanover or somewhere in northern Germany. You're married. You love your wife. And you have to stay here in Gibraltar for another few days. I gathered that much from your phone call in the bar."
The man looked at her, astonished.
"I'm from Sweden myself. I'm feeling an irresistible urge to have sex with somebody. I don't care if you're married, and I don't want your phone number."
He looked startled.
"I'm in room 711, on the floor above yours. I'm going to go up to my room, take a bath and get into bed. If you want to keep me company, knock on the door within 30 minutes. Otherwise I'll be asleep."
"Is this some kind of joke?"
he said as the elevator stopped.
"No. It's just that I can't be bothered to go out to some pick-up bar. Either you knock on my door or you don't."
25 minutes later there was a knock on the door of Salander's room. She had a bath towel around her when she opened the door.
"Come in,"
she said. He stepped inside and looked around the room suspiciously.
"I'm alone here,"
she said.
"How old are you, actually?"
She reached for her passport on top of a chest of drawers and handed it to him.
"You look younger."
"I know," she said, taking off the bath towel and throwing it onto a chair. She went over to the bed and pulled off the bedspread. She glanced over her shoulder and saw that he was staring at her tattoos.
"This isn't a trap. I'm a woman. I'm single. And I'll be here for a few days. I haven't had sex for months." "Why did you choose me?" "Because you were the only man in the bar who looked as if you were here alone. I'm married, and I don't want to know who she is or even who you are. And I don't want to discuss sociology. I want to fuck. Take off your clothes or go back down to your room."
"Just like that?"
"Yes. Why not? You're a grown man. You know what you're supposed to do."
He thought about it for all of 30 seconds. He looked as if he was going to leave. She sat on the edge of the bed and waited. He bit his lip. Then he took off his trousers and shirt and stood hesitantly in his boxer shorts.
"Take it all off," Salander said. "I don't intend to fuck somebody in his underwear. And you have to use a condom. I know where I've been, but I don't know where you've been."
He took off his shorts and went over to her and put his hand on her shoulder. Salander closed her eyes when he bent down to kiss her. He tasted good. She let him tip her back onto the bed. He was heavy on top of her. Jeremy Stuart Macmillan, Esquire, felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck as soon as he tried to unlock the door to his office at Buchanan House on Queensway Quay above the marina. It was already unlocked. He opened it and smelled tobacco smoke and heard a chair creak. It was just before 7, and his first thought was that he had surprised a burglar. Then he smelled the coffee from the machine in the kitchenette. After a couple of seconds, he stepped hesitantly over the threshold and walked down the hall to look into his spacious and elegantly furnished office. Salander was sitting in his desk chair, with her back to him and her feet on the windowsill. His PC was turned on. Obviously, she had not had any problem cracking his password, nor had she had any problem opening his safe. She had a folder with his most private correspondence and bookkeeping on her lap.
"Good morning, Miss Salander,"
he said at last.
"Ah, there you are," she said. "There's freshly brewed coffee and croissants in the kitchen."
"Thanks," he said, sighing in resignation. He had, after all, bought the office with her money, and at her request, but he had not expected her to turn up without warning. What's more, she had found, and apparently read a gay porn magazine that he kept hidden in a desk drawer.
So embarrassing.
Or maybe not. When it came to Salander, he felt that she was the most judgmental person he had ever met. But she never once raised an eyebrow at people's weaknesses. She knew that he was officially heterosexual, but his dark secret was that he was attracted to men. Since his divorce 15 years ago, he had been making his most private fantasies a reality.
It's funny, but I feel safe with her.